Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Let's Talk with Auntie Lilla Watson, Mary Graham and Christine Peacock.
Hello, my name's Christine Peacock. I'm a descendant of Erub in the Torres Strait, from Erub. Today I am speaking with Auntie Mary Graham and Auntie Lilla Watson, and we'd like to send our greetings to all traditional owners in this wonderful country of ours and invite you to listen to our conversation today. Auntie Mary, would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Mary Graham. I come from the Gold Coast in my father's people's area, the Combermere mob, who are part of the Big Yugambeh language group. And on my mother's side, she was a Waka Waka person from around about Gander, and from Cherbourg, which used to be called Baramba, but from that area. Yeah, thank you.
And Auntie Lilla.
Thank you, Chris, and good morning, everyone. I too would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we're on, and my country is my mum was a Kungaloo woman from central Queensland, and that's the country where I grew up, and my father was a Birriggubba man of the Wurri clan in north Queensland, and so that's my family history.
Thank you very much. The conversation will be informal, and we'll just converse the way that we see each other around the kitchen table or what have you. And so I would probably just like to ask either of you to respond to what you would think would be, I know there's a lot of them, but one of the pressing issues that you'd like to discuss today that's affecting our country.
Well, for me, I think that's what's really important, say, in the whole area of Aboriginal affairs and Aboriginal communities, is that we still don't have a voice. We don't have a collective voice in the form of our own representative system. We're the only English-speaking common law country in the world that doesn't have an agreement with the government of the day and the mainstream people. But especially, even if we didn't have a treaty, we still actually don't have any sort of formal mechanism by which we can represent ourselves. I think Indigenous people in all the other countries, that is the English-speaking common law countries, they do have some kind of system. And I think the fact that we don't have this representative system is a key part of why there are still so many social and political problems here. And the sooner the Australian government, has the courage to enter into discussions, which might take a long time, tease this out, to work on this, the longer those problems are going to continue, because as we saw in the a newspaper article talking about that Turnbull has got yet another advisory committee, six people, I think, and maybe headed by Mr. Sara, I think, who's a good man, and I don't know the others, but I don't doubt that they're very good people and well-meaning and honourable and so on. But the very fact that it's actually thought by government that something like a half a dozen people are going to be talking on behalf of 750,000 Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people around this country, it just beggars belief, So I think that's a major issue.
What would be your opinion of that, and also taking into account the fact that there have been advisory committees probably over yes. many generations?
That's for sure. Yes, I think that it's quite ridiculous, really, because government after government has always come up you know, with something a little bit different, but it's always based on Western terms of reference. And really and truly, what Aboriginal people have in our heads is something quite different from all the leadership concepts, you know, having leaders. Aboriginal people have something very different in our heads. And what happens, governments put up these policies, these solutions, these ideas, and Aboriginal people can only respond to it. We've never had the opportunity to say what it is that we need and we want and allow us to have control of that. It's always just responding to what governments put up, which of course then rebounds, and who gets the blame? Aboriginal people. Because it's never based on any understanding what Aboriginal terms of reference are. We've got a governance system that is very different from the Westminster system, and yet here people have been living here, you know, over 200 years now, and they still haven't learnt what that governance system is in regards to the Aboriginal populations in this country.
Mary, in your paper, The Philosophical Underpinnings, you spoke of what those Western terms of reference, where they come from, and not so much the impact of them, but you certainly talked about the difference between the Aboriginal terms of reference and Western terms of reference. Do you want to share that with people?
Well, there's several of them, but some of the most basic ones, of course, is their views of who and what human beings are, first of all. You're individuals, you know, they're individuals, and property-owning individuals, and the idea of the principles of organisation are based on, like, very basic things like hierarchies, and any form of hierarchy, or a range of, you know, all hierarchies are not exactly the same, but it has a basic shape there that has remained all the way through. The idea of course, you know, the agricultural, widespread industrial size sort of agricultural sort of system, which led towards competitiveness, into war, you know, between different tribal groups early, you know, in the early days, in the, you know, less than 10,000 years ago, you know, and so on. War is seen not as a negative thing. It's seen as a kind of a sense of glory. There's a gloriness about it. If you look at and read old books, old stories about like Homer's Iliad and things like that, they worship, they hold up in high regard those warrior figures. Now, I know a lot of cultures do that. Not European either. You know, all sorts of cultures around the world do that. But I think they. The Western system actually puts those sorts of values into their principles of organisation, the way they have ordered society, actually. So it's a hierarchical, it's hierarchy in the family sort of sense too, you know, father, the son, the male is at the head of it, kings, you know, sometimes queens, but generally, you know, male kind of monarchy. And even to the various experiments that Rome had, like republics, triumvirates, and usually always men, you know, and quite often like war making, and especially taking over other people's territory. So those sorts of terms of reference, those sorts of ways of ordering their society, is more or less the same. It's gotten slicker, more technologically. Driven, more technologically complex. And, of course, the economy that they eventually worked out, actual economics, going from basic mercantile, merchants controlling monies and funds and so on to an actual economy, that's run in a warlike way too, actually. So there's heaps of them. It just depends on where you want to start. But and colonialism, as we, you know, Lilla and I know, we used to lecture on this at University of Queensland, and over the years we've talked about both colonialism and imperialism, And that has not stopped. And that's a never-ending source of amazement, probably not only to Aboriginal people, but to many Indigenous people, that that kind of, ordering of the world, colonialism, imperialism, still remains today. That is an amazing thing when you think about it. You know?
And that's also the way that they frame sovereignty and the international law around that, which means we're dragged into that as well without any terms of reference that we can use to even address, you know, things that don't work in their ideas of sovereignty. Lila, you have, over the years, you've really determined and defined for us who, you know, want to understand those things, what Aboriginal terms of reference are in relation to those sorts of things that we have to live with. Well, how would you describe the way that this could, our Aboriginal terms of reference, how they could be used to address those problems that arise from that for us?
Yes, I think that for all the time we've lived in this country, which has been quite a long time, one of the things I think that Aboriginal people developed was a wonderful, wonderful understanding of what it means to be human, and have developed to such an extent that there's this great psychology of what that means, and yet not many people have this understanding that Aboriginal people have developed. You know, as you know, Mary and I have often said, the land has taught us. It's like the land invented us to look after it. And in doing that, it developed a world of obligations towards land, because land is the most sacred thing in our whole world. And, of course, it's how you treat land is how we should treat each other. And in doing that, we learn how to become more and more human and understand that we're just one of another species in this world, and that we have to look after everything around us. That obligation incurs that. And I think that in the Western world, their brains have developed great technology that all in the name of progress, and it's been at the expense of human development and human understanding. So we see this out-of-control technology that has damaged the earth, but not only damaged the earth to the extent it has, that we have this terrible situation of global warming, but it's damaged other human beings to the extent that they think it's all right. Many people think it's all right, this progress, to just keep on. You know, this technology just keeps growing and growing and overtaking. And I think it's been at the expense of understanding what humanness is all about. And that's what Aboriginal people really have to offer.
We might go for a break, because that's we've dealt with a great deal of issues there just in the conversation. So we should go for a little break at the moment and come back to what it means when the government does actually choose people from our society to represent us in the way that Mary described before, and how that impacts upon us, and how that can be changed if we were to use Aboriginal terms of reference to address what the government wants as an advisory committee.
You're tuned to Let's Talk, a weekly current affair program hosted by First Nations people for First Nations peoples. This is Let's Talk with Auntie Lila Watson, Mary Graham and Christine Peacock.
Hi, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Christine Peacock, and I'm talking with Auntie Mary Graham and Auntie Lila Watson. We're in conversation at Radio 98.9 FM. Mary, we were discussing before the Advisory Council and the Advisory Committee that has been put in place by the present Liberal Party government in Canberra. Could you talk a bit more about maybe the history of those sorts of advisory councils? And Lilo, you might like to respond as well, because the information about them is something that we need to have more of a conversation around, and that doesn't seem to be happening at all.
Well, it seems to me, when I read that this morning, it seemed to me that to be like, you know, when we talk about colonialism a little? It's like as if, we know colonialism happened everywhere in the world, right? You touched on a whole lot of people and ruined a whole lot of cultures, hundreds of millions of people, really, around the world. And in some places, like the places like US and Canada and, well, Australia, of course, and others, they shifted their system here. So in some places, like Australia, I think their colonial system, that is the system of government and governance and treating people, the citizens, the laws, administrative systems, legislation, and making legislation, making rules, and so on. If somehow here in this country, it hasn't actually changed. It seems like that to me, anyway. I don't know how it seems to me, but it seems like the political class in this country has remained fully colonial.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, what we read in the paper about this, yet another advisory committee, and advisory committees, you know, as everyone knows, they're paper tigers, really.
Yes.
You know?
They don't have any power.
Have no power.
They just make a sound. Yeah.
That's it. And they don't have to be listened to. And that's actually one of the things. He said a couple of good things, Sarah, about conditions.
They will find it very frustrating.
That's right.
Trying to get anything done by governments.
Because they won't be listened to.
No.
You know? We can guarantee now.
There might be small little things that might happen, but anything of great gain or anything, you know, it just won't happen.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I really feel sorry for those sort of committees that are appointed, because one of the great weapons of colonialism is myth-making, and that myth-making happens before they even set foot on the shore.
Or before they get onto a committee.
Yes.
It's already there, you know. What can we do about this terrible problem?
One of the greatest myths that white Australians have invented for themselves is that colonialism is something that happened in the past and it only happened to Aboriginal people.
Exactly.
Where, of course, we know full well that the impact of colonialism on white Australia has been great, because really and truly, white Australia has been invented by colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
And that invention is still happening.
Mm.
So what's happening, you know, colonialism just hasn't affected Aboriginal people. It's still ongoing and affecting white Australia.
Mm.
But as yet, they haven't gained the maturity to be able to look at that and see it to what extent it affects them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the colonial mentality in governments, we can see that colonial mentality in the policies they develop towards Aboriginal people, especially things like the intervention in the Northern Territory. I mean, that's unbelievable. Denial of human rights to their own citizens, which is, you know, I'm still aghast. I still can't believe it. So it's this colonial mentality that is all the time giving direction to policies in regards to Aboriginal people. And that's one of the most powerful weapons of colonialism is this myth-making. And they make up these myths. They're doing the best for Aboriginal people. And in some way, we're supposed to be grateful. We should be grateful they're doing this for us. You know, at the same time, they're standing on our necks.
But even their system of making policy is actually, in general, it says, not just to do with Aboriginal affairs, but it's actually very old-fashioned compared with a whole lot of other places, you know.
Yes.
People have gradually learnt that it's in other countries that it's a better idea. It's a more efficient idea to be working with people. Although I must say, at the same time, there are big general economic policies that are coming out where, you know, you hear about the 1% and the big gap between rich and poor, and it's getting wider and wider, austerity policies and so on, where people who have wealth and power, they want even more wealth and power, and governments are their servants, basically. So I often think of Aboriginal people as being in... I use the term of about like a caboose. You know, the caboose is the last, what do you call it, carriage in a train,
yes.
You know, where the luggage goes, I think, and where all boxes and rubbish goes. And it's like as if the Indigenous people are there. We're being carried along. We're being carried along
by this
Western
train,
ways. This train, which doesn't know where it's going.
Where it's going.
Yes.
And we don't know where we're going to end up.
And the other passengers in the forward part compartments, you know, they don't know either, but they're hanging on for dear life.
Yes.
You know, and funds, you know, the economy is getting worse and worse, actually.
Absolutely.
So more and more poor people. Mm. So in a sense, we're going to be, on this larger scale, I mean, we're going to be even at greater risk, actually, of being poor. Do you know, because there'll be more poor people, mainstream, competing against.
Are increasing, you know?
Yeah.
And the rich,
yeah.
It's all around the world. Rich are getting richer.
Yes.
And I mean,
So I actually think that as far as terms of reference goes, we are really going to have to fall back or quite realistically choose our own terms of reference, as in, insisting on being independent, but actually going ahead and not waiting for government to tell us to be independent.
Yeah,
we're just going to have to do things ourselves and not rely on government funding. And that is really hard. That is going to be very hard, harder than people think, really. But here we are. We're Aboriginal, you know, Indigenous people in this country. We've the first human government in the world.
We know the earliest.
So we're probably the only peoples in the world that has run a whole country earlier than everybody else. So it shouldn't be that. We should think that it shouldn't be. It's not going to be. It's not going to be easy, but it's not going to be something that's going to defeat us.
No,
because we are not defeated by colonialism. But we really do have to get, like, not, what did somebody once say? Something about don't get angry, get smart, you know. we're going to have to, our imagination and our, you know, creativity is, Chris Peacock.
So we could say that conquest stops here.
That's exactly right, yes. Yeah, the red line for... colonial takeovers.
Stop.
Yes, absolutely.
We might just go for a break, and because we've covered a lot of ground there, and we can just continue on in the vein of what we actually see in our own actions that's positive. Because, I mean, there's the Black Card program, and there's loads of other things, I'm sure, that we can say that when the power is being used by ourselves in a creative way, that we actually do make a difference, that it's not being heard and seen because the powers that be probably aren't interested or whatever that might be. We'll come back in a minute.
You're tuned to Let's Talk, a weekly current affair program hosted by First Nations people for First Nations peoples. This is Let's Talk with Auntie Lilla Watson, Mary Graham and Christine Peacock.
Hello, here still with Auntie Mary Graham and Auntie Lilla Watson, and we're having a conversation today at 98.9 FM, which I'm hoping you're enjoying. We've just been talking about the ways in which Aboriginal society, at the hands of a colonial regime, actually in many ways can't function in the way that we would normally function. But at the same time, we have to say our functionality is still in good form, and our resistance and our the ways in which we actually go about doing things on a day-to-day basis with our families and our clan groups and on our countries has suffered, but it hasn't disappeared or vanished, and it certainly hasn't been conquered. So I'd like to invite Mary and Lilla again to speak about the ways in which they observe that resilience operating, you know, like the things that they actually do, the actions that we take, the just the day-to-day ways in which we conduct ourselves that keeps us healthy and keeps us alive and keeps us contributing in a very positive way to where this country's headed.
Yes, that's a really good question, comment.
It is.
Because it goes to the heart of the whole like conversation that we've been having, and that is where does this strength, you could say it's a spiritual sort of strength actually,
yes,
that comes
right.
from Aboriginal people, and it comes from all those thousands of years of experiences, Lily, as you talk about, you know, thousands
yes.
of years of running the country, basically.
Mm.
And as we always say, everybody around the country sort of says, we're owners and runners of this country, plus that we have been, you know, the first governments right across the country, the whole country. So it's sort of built in. It's built into the culture, into our thinking, into our ordering and organising of our our societies. And while there are still some terrible things via colonial actions and events, you know, the cruelty of authorities, say, for example, the not good relationship with police and other kinds of, you know, prisons and deliberate, domination, basically, by this,
yes.
by this sort of government, this colonial government, really. There is something just very, very strong and very quiet about our insistence on being
who
we are and what we do and whose country
yes.
really this is. Mm. And we do it in such a wonderful way. I am always amazed because it's not even ideological. Do you know? I mean, if we did it in an ideological way, we'd be seeing whitefellas as our enemies, basically.
Absolutely.
We'd be seeing them as the enemy who has to be beaten and that we have to fight back at every opportunity and so on. We organise ourselves in a particularly ideological way by a party or something like that. I mean, like an actual very strong nationalist sort of movement. And while there's a kind of a nationalism there, but it's symbolic, really, and you can see it most plainly in the flag. You know, there's hundreds of different mobs, but one flag.
Yes.
Do you know that unites us all?
That
and yet we're not.
Us, and that's that
yes.
was very clever, so, that flag.
That was so clever. And it's just it's a flag. It's a signal, isn't it? It's a signal
yes.
that, and it reminds me of. I always remember this one paper I read to do with in the Northern Territory. I think it was to do with land rights, not so much Native Title, but Justice Gray was talking about the problems of land rights, Native Title, and so on and so on. And at the end of the paper, he said something about this will remain a problem in Australian law. The fact that Aboriginal people everywhere still imagine the country to be theirs. And I laughed like mad when I read that because I thought, well, you're absolutely dead set right because
yes.
every Aboriginal person in the whole country, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person,
we know.
Everywhere we know, yes, indeed, the country's ours and we don't have to even proclaim it from, you know, high mountains or anything like that. We just lived from day to day, just
yes.
insist.
Yes.
Insistence. What's it all saying? Insistence, resist, insist,
persistence.
Persistence.
Persistence. Mm. And I think that's just
it's wonderful.
The wonderful thing yeah. about our culture is this great strength that Aboriginal people have on insistence. You know, resistance is something that, I mean, I know a lot of people use it, but Aboriginal people really insisting on who we are. It's like we're planted in the ground and it doesn't matter. They can't push us over, they can't roll over us, they can't move us.
No.
We are planted in the ground and we insist on who we are.
Mm.
Resistance is not a strong enough word, well, because it's always pushing against someone. They're always trying to fight against someone.
Well, we did resist in the beginning, eh? We had our own Geronimos, and you know what I mean? The actual straight sort of colonial resistance, that sort of thing. But
it's this great insistence on who we are that is so important to me.
It melded into that, eh?
And what has happened with the event of colonialism, I just find it just magnificent and so wonderful, is how Aboriginal people have taken on these things that have come out of the event of colonialism, like Aboriginal English, for instance. You know, how Aboriginal people have taken hold of the English language and we've turned it into an Aboriginal language in the added meaning we've given to the English word. And I think that's just magnificent myself, because, you know, so many of our people were stopped from learning our own languages. And people want to say, oh, you destroy language, you destroy people. And I just laugh, because I know how Aboriginal people have just taken that on, and we've made it, this English language, into a language for ourselves by the added meaning we give to those words. And when we talk about family, a lot of you know, a lot of white people think, oh, well, I know, they're talking about the family. When you talk about family,
kinship,
you know, it's extended family.
Extended family, yes.
And they think that's what it is. Whereabouts in Aboriginal English, family includes non-blood relatives. And quite often, you know, we've got white family members who are non-blood relatives as well. And then you have to really extend it again, because it includes the whole community as our family. And we exercise responsibilities and obligations to our community. And that's, you know, included in this language now that we use. And those obligations and are so important. I always talk about how I was down West End one time, and there was a young man, two young men walking towards where I was, and two policemen coming from the opposite direction. And the two policemen bailed up these young men quite close to me and started questioning them. And I could see one of them was really scared, you know, and they allowed one fella to go, and they kept the really scared kid there. And I just went over and I put my arm around him, and I said, are you all right, nephew? And he said, thank you, auntie. And I just said to those policemen, is there something wrong here? What's the problem? And they just said, oh, we just wanted to know if he knew the address of someone. I said, oh, well, are you finished now? And they said, oh, yes, it's all right. And they just wandered on. Yeah. But I'd never seen that young Aboriginal man before, and he hadn't seen me. But I had an obligation to that young man, and he recognised me immediately, you know, as an older person, an older responsible person. And see, that's what we now give to this English, these English words we use. And to me, that's so important, because what's happening is, and it's becoming more noticeable, is our insistence on our Aboriginal culture. We are insisting on our Aboriginal culture. And what we are doing now, it's arming our young people more and more with culture. We have to arm our young people with culture so that they can build their strength and they can stand on their feet and say who they are from a knowledge base that goes back thousands of years. That's what's important about insistence on our culture.
And the thing that I really like too is, doesn't matter where it is, whether it's, you know, there's this insisted upon distinction that governments make, not only people like anthropologists and so on, but some anthropologists, but some other, you know, some main parts of mainstream want to insist on this distinction between remote, real Aboriginals, in other words, and urban peoples, you know, 50,000 people here live in Brisbane, apparently. Now the population is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. But they want to say that, oh, well, we're really kind of like the mainstream. So they want to insist that we're, what's that word? When we're forced to join, forced to join the majority. It's on the tip of my tongue. I'm sorry what it means.
I know, I couldn't find a word.
Oh, God, isn't it awful?
It's like an integration.
Yeah, an integration. You know what I mean?
Assimilation.
Assimilation, that's right.
That's it.
And it's an enforced, and the policies are definitely enforced assimilation, you know. And so that, but they want to make a, they want to say that, oh, well, you know, you, you know, what is the difference? You know, you like football, Aboriginal people like football, and
like
we do all these things,
too.
We have business, like various technologies
like
and so on and so on. And it's that if they think that that is what assimilation actually is, I think they're quite wrong,
because
here we are, you know, the majority of people living around the edges, kind of thing, like a lot in urban areas, but still insisting on protocols and things like that. Do you know, we wouldn't be insisting on those protocols if we weren't, if we were fully assimilated,
we're
and so
not
on.
Assimilated.
You know, we're not in the we're not assimilated in the most fundamental. Fundamentally important ways, and that's our that's quiet strength.
Yeah.
You know,
perhaps also you know, as much as they've insisted that we integrate and assimilate, something that's, I don't know, maybe it's inherited, like could be part of our DNA even, is that we have a very strong value system.
Very strong,
and
yes,
we understand the world through that value system.
Yes.
Because like I recall growing up, you know, with my mum and my dad. My dad's not an Aboriginal person, but he was within our family, like you were talking before about white people being brought into the family. He found somewhere to live there that that equated with his sense of integrity and ethics, you know. He was that sort of person,
human being.
And he wanted to be there. He stayed there, eight children, you know, looked after
Lovely.
Them. He was only a barber and then had accident, ended up in the railways, you know, because his back wasn't any good. But he wanted to be with us, you know. He wasn't going anywhere.
Yes.
And he passed on his own sense of, you know, values to us as well. But that idea of caring for country, caring
for
kin is part of that
system, absolutely.
As well as the custodianship.
The custodial ethic.
Talk about the custodial ethic, which isn't just
ethic.
To do with land, but it's all encompassing. You know?
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's the template, the land template.
Template.
The land template, and then it goes into the whole. That's
and
true.
I sort of, you know, I think that that's the importance of us being able to take some form of power into our hands, like having a radio station.
Yes.
Because lots of people are missing out on being able to connect with that value system in the same way that we did when we were young, because we were still with the older people who were not that far away from you know, our own culture and country, being on country, because colonisation was still young. But as it advances, we need to use these opportunities to reach out.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because I think more and more people are becoming very dissatisfied with the way Western culture has worked in the past.
Mm.
And I think when they hear a different value system that concentrates more on what it means to be human, I think that really, really catches their attention, and I think it's something that more people can identify with.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the most amazing thing, though, too, that I think it is also the thing that makes us very, very strong. Also, is that our old system here, it really and truly is quite different from many other cultures, old cultures I'm talking about, not the settler colonial countries, but old cultures around the world. Quite different from the Middle East, from the Asia, from Africa, from the Europe, you know, the four big main, what's the names of, and the Americas, I guess, too. But we stand alone, because while our systems of that non-hierarchical, gender balance, but also territorial integrity.
Yes.
So there's no hierarchy there, where there's a dominating tribe or clan was, you know, dominating everybody else in order to gain security. Now, that happened all over the world with most other cultures, but didn't happen here. That is an amazing thing. And there's all kinds of offshoots from that in the kind of way we ordered society. We ordered not just culture, but... and it is a philosophy of life. It is, even though it's not a philosophy like the Europe and other cultures have. The straight meaning or definition of a philosophy is to look at the nature of a particular thing, a quality or an idea or something like that, or a thing like beauty or something, aesthetics. But it's a philosophy which is a worldview. So we have a worldview like many other old cultures have their own worldview. And the most amazing thing about it, ours, is that while we didn't have monumental architecture, you know, like great pyramids and sphinxes and wonderful Roman roads, you know, the last 2,000 years, it's amazing. It is amazing technology.
It is, absolutely.
But while we didn't have that kind of thing, although we did not too bad to discover, invent astronomy and art and things like that, they're not too bad.
Aerodynamics of the boomerang.
aerodynamics and things like that. The thing is that our worldview is based on monumental thinking. So we don't have monumental architecture, but we have this huge, big thinking, which is different from anywhere else. And that's what fascinates a whole lot of people.
It's very different from anywhere else.
And we've all had, you know, and Chris, to you, when we've talked to people over time, different ones, students, just people we're talking with, arguing with, white fellows mainly, or other cultures, they are just naturally fascinated with the basis of things that we talk about. We might be talking about it a lot, but it's definitely different, you know. So, for example, I have American students a couple of times a year. I have had for over a decade now. And for the first time ever, these more white American students, they are getting fed up with capitalism.
Yes.
And they're completely, what do you call it, dismissive now. Or not dismissive, but tired of democracy. The lies, what they see,
God.
And they say, the lies of democracy. I thought I'd never live
to
see the day.
White
American students are like that about their own system. And of course, some of them do say, you know, would be fantastic to have a different system, but where can you have it? You know, where do you have it? Now, by that too, I'm not saying that we should, you know, we offer this wonderful thing for, you know, this different system of ordering the world, or world order, social order, for everybody, because there were particular factors that were present when in the development of it, you know, in this country. It was isolated, you know. Nobody came to this country except over 200 years ago. But in all those thousands of years before, nobody came to take over. Do you know what I mean? So we're not used to big wars. Do you know what I mean? Really big wars, only in the last, like, 100 years, I suppose, you know, where some of our own people are actually in World War I and II and so on and so on. But we have that in our history, in our past, and it's in our present, though, too. That's the most wonderful, heartening thing.
Well, look, you as an artist, right, how did you see the arts, like, that comes from Aboriginal people? And it comes at all sorts of different levels, and I think probably for us the most unfortunate thing is the integration and assimilation that happens within that process too, in the sense that we have to apply for funding if we want to live off our artistic abilities, to places whose criteria often determines the way in which we're actually going to engage in our art in this world, right? But how do you see arts impacting on Australian society in a positive way in terms of conveying our value systems and conveying you know, who we are?
I think it's very important. I think people actually outside the country can appreciate and understand Aboriginal art more than the citizens of this country do. But I'm hoping that our art will eventually have a greater impact on the citizens of this country, because I see Aboriginal art, it's the voice of the land, and it's being expressed in so many ways.
Yes.
It seems to me just is gaining more and more power. The traditional people with their traditional layouts of land and dreaming stories, That's the land talking directly to the citizens of this country to say you can learn more about this land you live on and call home. Then we have another level of people who are putting up their experience in a more modern life and a more modern way, and it's saying exactly the same thing. It's saying the same thing, but they're using different ways of a different approach in what they're saying. There's no difference between the other. People want to talk about, oh, you know, traditional artists and urban artists and all this sort of, it's all nonsense as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, perhaps even using the term artist is a little bit foreign to us, because when I was growing up, and I've often shared that those stories with Mary about when she was growing up as well, because we actually share a place called Mossman in our history.
Yes, Mossman.
And in that place, my mob used to gather, you know, in Kuya Beach, and people would make instruments, you know, like out of tea chests, you know.
Yes,
would be a bass, you know.
A bass.
And everybody could play
a
guitar.
Made a guitar, kerosene tin.
Yeah. And, you know, spoons, what have you. We all have these experiences of being creative, you know, of being what I said before, creative. You know?
Creative, yes.
Because we're in our, and it's also in our actions, like we were discussing the philosophy of Mikhail Dustin, who's, that's not the way you pronounce it, I know, but anyway, it's close enough, I hope you can understand. Mikhail, it's a Russian philosopher who talked about the philosophy of the act, and that we can only really understand each other and appreciate each other by our actions. We can say what we like.
Yes, exactly.
But it's in the way that we behave towards each other.
Yes, conduct.
The decisions that we make, you know, and those, if we want to talk about those decisions, it's decisions that our old people made many years ago, not to go chasing down the idea of technology and changing the world,
or ideology,
things that are endlessly, you know, something that we cannot really determine what they're going to do. And we're looking at that now, which means we've actually reached a tipping point. And you know, the election of a president in America, the one that we've seen as such now, not that they've been that different in the past, but the one that we see now is an indication that we're looking for change. And I think probably we're at the, you know, we can, we really do have to recognise our value, or each and every one of us, not just the people who've been, you know, elevated to, you know, advisory committees or elevated to being artists or something. We have to actually all recognise that we have that strength and that we can meet that challenge head on, you know.
That's wonderful, Chris, because I just mentioned visual art, but I mean, it's all the arts that people are involved in, and so creative in that.
Yes.
And to me, it's all those things combined. It's really the land speaking.
Yes.
And
yes.
It doesn't matter what gender of art you belong to, or produce, or participate in. To me, it's just wonderful to see it, hear it, and see it, you know, because to me, it's the land coming through the voices, through the pictures, through the actors, through the dancers. Yes. To me, it's all just so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope more and more of us can hear it, see it, and appreciate it.
Mm.
And it's making our spirituality stronger and stronger.
Absolutely.
I was going to say that. There's something about the processing. I think it's a generally held view. I think most people, humans anyway, that any kind of expression, creative expression, is processing the impact of it, the emotional and feeling impact, but all the different impacts, including especially spirituality. And I was wondering too that even in the modern sense of a political kind of impact, I was wondering, what do you reckon about an idea, Lil and Chris, about two different artistic creations, one from us, whatever artist could do it, but we give in a painting form, in the form of a painting, but it could be any form, but especially a painting form. It could be accompanied by a one-act play, you know, painting with along with a one-act play, or a tableau, you know, at a tableau like that sort of thing, of an invoice for this country sent to white Australian, especially the government, an invoice, and it might be a canvas with nothing but zeros on it, you know.
I like that.
Nothing but it, because it's priceless, of course, so there's nothing but a whole sea of circles. But a really creative artist would come up with something like that, along with, so it's a double act kind of creative thing so it's our kind of thing to them, saying this is what you owe us, actually, essentially. This is what having a whole country for nothing, this is what it costs, actually. Now, and then, of course, they could, if they really... think about it. There's this famous Picasso painting called Guernica. It's an anti-war painting. Yeah. It's very world famous. It's wonderful, wonderful painting. Oh, huge, big painting, I think. With a one of those ones with lots of different images in it, you know, but it's all anti-war.
Yes.
A white Australian should do that. I think a white Australian artist should do that as a comment on colonialism and imperialism, but in the form of an art. Of a painting, do you know, and
that'd
call it that, but some, because nobody's really done that. There's thousands of paintings of brave heroic types, you know, Washington and, you know, Bligh out here and Captain Cook probably, and all that kind of stuff, but there's nothing here. There might be an individual painting about one of our own heroic people, you know, but nothing as a straight out comment on imperialism and colonialism. You know,
although,
and that would be wonderful,
artist.
But because I think a white fella has to do it.
Actually,
a white cathartic, exactly,
yes,
Chris.
No,
yes.
Actually, there is a show in London at the moment.
Oh, right, yes.
By this artist who's made quite a comment.
Yes.
On Australian colonial society.
Really?
Mm. It was in the Guardian.
I just recent.
Remember.
Right.
Very recent. Yeah.
Oh,
well, they're catching up slowly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that's amazing. That is amazing.
We're going to perhaps. Sorry, Mary. We've reached the end of our time for this conversation today, but we've obviously picked up on lots of things that this conversation can continue with at another time. Do you think we'd just each of us
I'd love to come back again.
Yawo
and ta-ta for now. And whatever.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Chris. And bye, listeners, and I hope we'll be back again soon.
Yes, ditto for me too. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you very much. It's really lovely to be able to share the knowledge of our elders in this way, and particularly these two women here whose experience in life and experience of Aboriginal affairs is a great contribution to our country. Thank you.
You've been tuned to Let's Talk, highlighting the injustice from community to country, suburb to city, with a multitude of hosts, Bo Spearham, Carver Watson, the aunties Lilla Watson and Mary Graham, and Chelsea Bond. Weekday mornings from 9 till 10, it's Let's Talk, welcoming the continued sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country.